Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today, we are very fortunate to have Dr. Zena Crenshaw-Logal, who is the Executive Director of the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project. Her works have been renowned and cited throughout the country as well as internationally, particularly in the United Nations. So with that, we'd like to welcome Dr. Crenshaw-Logal.
Hi, how are you, Dr. Jossi? I'm so happy to have an opportunity to talk with you in the Daily Remedy.
Well, I appreciate your time. It's our honor. So for the audience, can you let them know a little bit more about what your role is specifically in judicial advocacy? Because it's a big issue, but you have been razor focused on one specific component. So before we delve into the work that you've done, can you help the audience better understand what exactly it is that you focus on?
Okay, well, you know, the name of our organization, and it's quite a tongue twister, but it says it all, the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project, Inc. So we're looking at judicial conduct and also disabilities of judges that could affect their performance, official performance on the bench. So, you know, for example, a judge may start showing indications of Alzheimer's or compromised cognitive state. And so we look at, it's a project, all things that deal with judicial conduct and disability. We look at it, and when our organization was founded, our focus was on one particular form of judicial misconduct that's particularly egregious that we call judicial collusion. And that's basically when the presiding judge enters into either an implicit or explicit agreement to favor one party or another. It's an improper form of judicial bias. So that was the beginning of our focus, when the presiding judge becomes part of a deliberate violation of our federal rights.
How big of a problem is this?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, because at the beginning of this century, people across the country were coming onto the internet, and they were saying, I'm having a problem. I'm involved in a legal case and I'm being railroaded, and the judge is letting it all happen, or the judge seems to be very much spearheading this miscarriage of justice. And at one point, just through that level of exchange, it seemed clearly like it was at least a million of us directly impacted. Now, that it's like 21 years just about have passed. People have moved on, passed away. So it's not clear. And then, of course, it's a big tech censoring. So it's not as clear what our numbers are. But insofar as people directly impacting, there are a lot of people out there still prepared to say it's at least a million of us. And when you look at the nuclear family of the people who are directly impacted, then you see that the problem has an intergenerational effect. And at that point, you're talking about tens of millions of people.
So let's contrast that with something that's a bit more tangible and overt in our society, police misconduct. Do you feel that, as you had mentioned, implicit or explicit agreements, do you feel that the subjectivity or the biases in judges are harder to define compared to more overt actions of police misconduct, and that's why it's not getting the attention it deserves?
Thank you for pointing that out, because that is a point I've been trying to pound into, you know, everyone's mind that's directly impacted by this problem. Because so many people take when they consider what is the solution, they take their cues from historical movements for rights, women's suffrage, the civil rights movement. And what they're missing is, number one, the establishment is become more sophisticated. And so the notion that we're just going to lock arms and walk across a bridge and then everything is going to be okay, you know, they're not going along with that as readily as they did back in the 60s. But the more pressing problem is it's a lot easier for people to understand that a woman should have a right to vote, or a segment of our population shouldn't be subjected to lynching, than it is for us to know whether a judge, a judicial ruling is a reflection of improper bias, a deliberate violation of rights. And I mean, you know, you can say it, but who knows whether your review of what happened is not just subjective and not the only way of looking at how the case was addressed. I mean, you can't get, most of us who have experienced this judicial collusion, we have boxes of evidence, you know, legal papers, and we've painstakingly kept up with the evidence of this seeming agreement to deliberately violate our rights. You can't get these boxes summarized on a picket sign. So yes, it is a big problem that it's a much more elusive form of human rights violation than a law enforcement officer beating you, you know, putting their knee on your neck, that you don't need a legal brief to understand the rightness or the wrongness of that type of activity.
So the complexity of the issue often makes it difficult for people to understand. What have you seen and what actions have you taken to make your message effectively resonate among the public?
A couple of turning points. In 2010, a really stellar coalition of activists, public interest attorneys, we had and some accomplished public interest attorneys. We had the indirect support of constitutional law scholars through their affidavits, through their writings, and then some of the most accomplished grassroots activists. And we went to the United Nations. It was during what's called a universal periodic review of the United States of America's human rights record. And in a 10-page, what's called a stakeholders report, we explain that when rogue agents of government align themselves to deliberately violate our rights, there doesn't seem to be any amount of legal training, sophistication as an advocate, community support that can fend that off. So at that point, in fact, our ability to effectively resist an orchestrated violation of our rights that seemed to compromise government oversight at every juncture of review. You know, so you're in the trial court, you file a motion for, you know, reconsideration, you go up on appeal, you go to your legislator, every juncture of oversight seemed to be compromised. And it had gone on so long that we were able to go with the stellar panel who were prepared to say to the United Nations that what should be our inalienable constitutional rights were pretty much not much more than privileges doled out, you know, at the discretion of government. And at best, we could just hope that the government would be magnanimous. So that was the first turning point where you had accomplished people prepared to say, this is just not all in our heads. This is just not me thinking very subjectively that I was treated unfairly. We're seeing too broadly across the nation that whether you're a sophisticated advocate or not, no matter how much training you have, I mean, you could have spent your life as a lawyer dealing with prosecuting collusion cases, but when the fix was in, when you became a target, all of it was ineffective. So that was a turning point that we were prepared to say that to the United Nations, but lo and behold, it actually got worse. And so 5 years later, was the next turning point. Do you want me to go into that?
Yes, please. And then I kind of want to get your sense on the trends that you're seeing now. I think that's a great segue.
Okay. Well, the next turning point happened literally about 5 years later. 5 years later, and we're already saying with you know, very reputable support that something is amiss, that the ability of average Americans to effectively petition our government just was illusory. You would think that would chill what we were experiencing. Instead, it continued to proliferate. And by 2015, we were able to detect and document an objectively discernible national pattern. And that's important for your listeners to understand. The organization I co-founded, the National Judicial Conduct and Disability Law Project, we call it the Law Project for short. We were looking at these reports, this phenomenon across the nation. So we weren't an organization which was like a voice for the targeted populations. We were more of an analyst of what was the phenomena that they were being subjected to. And we were able to identify a distinct pattern of legal system abuse that occurred in every single case, from someone who felt that they were not fairly treated in the context of a child protective services to someone who, a whistleblower, who had their life derailed through legal process.
Wow.
So that was the next turning point.
That is a major issue that I kind of want to learn a little bit more about and talk further. Objectively discernible pattern is a very powerful phrase, right? Because essentially what you are proving is that through these anecdotal cases, through these personalized incidences that many people who have been disenfranchised struggle to articulate, through that mess, if you will, you were able to discern patterns objectively, which meant that you were able to demonstrate significant statistical significance in the biases that took place at a judicial level. Can you talk a little bit more about how that came about?
First of all, you know, I just could hug you, Dr. Joshi, because you are so perceptive, you know, because, you know, it's like that's like the ta-da I've been hoping people would get for years, just how important it was to document, to identify this objectively discernible pattern, you know, because so many people were like, well, I knew the fix was in, but to say that it's a pattern moves us away from the subjective and starts to reinforce the notion that it's deliberate, because it becomes arguably a statistical improbability that random people with all this anecdotal evidence would be experiencing the same type of problem through very distinct modalities. And as part of a use, we say a misuse of the legal system that serve five distinct goals. So now in the process, tell me again, what were you asking me specifically about that? The importance of the objective discernible pattern?
When we look at judges and the manner in which they make rulings, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to identify biases in just one ruling.
Yes.
It's very difficult to identify patterns of biases in a group of rulings. Clearly, to be able to identify objectively discernible patterns, yes. you must have seen a bias, not just in a decision from the judges, but in the actions taken over the course of the legal proceedings. Just want you to talk a little bit more about how these patterns formed in your mind and how you were able to discern them.
Okay. Thank you for refreshing me my understanding of what we're trying to look at. We identified five goals that were served in every time a litigant, a disfavored litigant, a targeted litigant was subjected to this phenomenon that we call the third degree. There were always five distinct goals being served. I don't have them handy, but one of the goals were to get you incarcerated, discredit you, to it becomes a personal attack. It was five distinct goals that were always served, and none of those goals included a fair and impartial resolution of the dispute that was before the court. Then it was
what I would like to do, and sorry to interrupt, Doctor. Mm-hmm. I will provide a link to those five goals because I think it's important for the audience to understand that effectively what you did in your research, where you're able to demonstrate beyond just random probability, five goals that took place as miscarriages of justice that took place on a consistent basis that you then defined as biased judicial proceedings.
Yes, you know, well, yes, exactly. Because the goal of a judicial proceeding is a fair and impartial resolution of the dispute. And instead, when you're the target, one or more of these five goals invariably are being served. So if you are believing that you're being subjected to this deliberate violation of rights, but we can't detect one or more of these five goals, then our contention is you probably are not the target of this deliberate violation of rights. And then we also identify seven modalities. They have seven different ways that is always used across the country to accomplish this goal. Seven different ways. One or more of these techniques are used in every case, no matter the how much the fact pattern might vary.
So that's interesting because you clearly structured the manner in which something hard to define, judicial bias, takes place in the courts. For somebody who's not well-versed in the legal profession or somebody who has not directly experienced such biased rulings, often there is a issue of credibility. People may say, well, why did you plead guilty if you weren't guilty? Or why don't you just appeal the ruling? What do you say to those people that have a hard time recognizing just how important of a problem this is?
Well, that's part of the hardship of being subjective to this experience, because people, you know, we're in a country that's the architect of the gold standard. The U.S. legal system is the gold standard of processes for a fair and impartial administration. And here people know that there's corruption, there's miscarriages of justice, but you know, it's almost we're triggering cognitive dissonance when we're saying that some often very well-esteemed jurists use legal process to retaliate for your First Amendment rights or oppress a particular population. For example, mass incarceration. That is to the extent that we're generating wrongful convictions, there's the prospect of that being an orchestrated phenomenon. So it's hard to have people not believe you, and it doesn't make any difference. I mean, my closest colleagues, when I suggested that legal disciplinary processes were used in such a way to silence lawyers who were engaged in First Amendment activities that were challenging the legal establishment or challenging government, they were like, oh, that's hard. You know, really? You know, Zena, you must have, you know, they must have done something wrong. You know, that was the response. Now, so to answer your question, how we dealt with that, we just continued to present the problem in as balanced manner as possible. And over the years, social science researchers started to study related issues and developments. And that also helped. For example, I think it was Syracuse University. They did a study in 2014, if I'm not mistaken, and they were able to document that nearly 100% of the time, there is a refusal on the Justice Department to prosecute or even authorize investigation of a case where there's an allegation of this unlawful judicial bias. Nearly 100% of the time, even when the FBI was recommending that an investigation. So the notion that we weren't, and then of course you probably are familiar, they have documented that judicial disciplinary bodies nearly 100% of the time, there is a declination, there is a determination that there was not misconduct. And most of the time, a peremptory, there's no type of thorough investigation. You're thrown out on your ear right at the pleading stage without the judge even having to answer. So that doesn't prove that, yes, in fact, you or I were subjected to improper judicial bias. What it started to establish is that we don't have a forum that's giving fair and partial consideration of our evidence. And that helped to, because, you know, part of the people, when people are saying, you know, that's hard to believe, what they're thinking is if what you're saying is really true, it's going to be brought out, you know, just, you know, maybe you just got the wrong lawyer. You know, maybe you really did do something, you know. So the more we show that no matter with regard to nearly 100% of the people who are making these claims, no one prevails, then it becomes much more believable that maybe your bad outcomes is not because your case is flawed, that or that you, in fact, were not target of deliberate rights violation, but your claims are not being fairly and impartially delivered.
Understood. I like the way you broke that down, because you look at this very amorphous issue as systematically as possible. And I think that's one of your strengths. When you talk about judicial collusion, mm-hmm. you recently stated it's an orchestrated phenomenon. I want to tease that out a little bit, because biases, as we're starting to learn, can be implicit subconscious biases, or they can be overt attempts to disenfranchise or remove a person's rights. In your analysis, do you see this more as simply subconscious biases that take place through the judicial machinations, or do you always inevitably see in legitimate cases of judicial misconduct that there was an overt attempt from at least one member, whether it's the government or the judicial body?
Well, one of the things that was brought out, and I published a book along with a panel of law professors who focused in on judicial ethics. And one of the problems in our country is that our bench, the judiciary, is so dominated by former prosecutors, former government employees, former corporate attorneys. And there is an implicit bias. You know, we have focused in on diversity, race, gender, even religion. But what one of the things that my book addresses, and it's not just because it was my idea, the book is a report of this conference where we brought these activists and public interest attorneys and law professors all together to discuss the phenomena of whether we can really rely on our legal system to you know, stay anchored by the rule of law. And so what we pointed out is that there's a bias of perspective. So, you know, if you have worked for the government and now you're a judge, and someone is trying to expose agency misconduct, you are not operating in a vacuum, and you are going to be inclined to see that person, at least at some level, as a troublemaker. And it's just hard for that not to color how you respond. Whereas if you were like me, a former plaintiff's personal injury lawyer, which I focused on relatively complex violations of rights, then, you know, I'm focused on First Amendment rights, the public interest being served. These are at the forefront of my mind. So I'm going to respond differently to that plaintiff than the defense-oriented judge. And And it's about us being ethical and doing our job, but also it's about a balance of perspectives on the bench. Okay, so that's one thing. But insofar as being able to prove unlawful bias, this is another thing that people don't always get. You're going to have evidence that there was an obstinate disregard for your rights by the judge. And that is at times an element of proof that's hard to establish. So you're going to have to show that you know, for however you did it, that's basically you were pounding across the judge's head what the law requires, what your rights entail. And the judge in a repeated fashion disregarded that or acted inconsistent with that admonition. And there's not a lot of guidance. There's not a lot of case law that helps people identify unlawful judicial bias. I've written about that in at least one of my law review articles, that, you know, the judiciary says they you would think that they would be interested in helping us be clear on what the line is between proper and improper lines of discretion. But what they do is they don't very well develop the body of law that gives you some indication what the criteria is. They just give a general platitude and then you think you have it. And so you pro se, or you hire a lawyer and you make the allegation that you've been the subject of this improper bias. And then they look at your evidence and you got 10 pieces of evidence. I'm just being facetious. And they say, oh no, well, you have to have 12. You know, if they just would rule that you had to have 12, you would have never filed the lawsuit. You know, instead the ruling, the case law says you have to have more than 8. So you file and you with your 10, and then they rule you have to have 12. And then you file with 12 and they rule that, but in these circumstances, you need 15.
So it's clearly an example of where they're moving the goalpost, where there's subjectivity in the interpretation. For the audience, can you delve a little bit more on this case issue or case law phenomenon and the issue that it poses? So how significant of an issue is it that there's a lack of case law for this particular matter of judicial accountability?
Oh, it's very, very significant. It's very significant. Our organization also identified a phenomenon called judicial engineering. And judicial engineering, if I can recall, basically, there are certain things that a judge is supposed to do and not do that is so well established that you don't even find case law on it. You know, one of my co-founders is a historian. He's a lawyer and historian. And as a result, he identified some historical cases that I wish I could think of an example. None is coming to mind, but just historical principles that 100 years ago or more, it was, but of course, this, a judge should not do this, or a judge should not do this, or that, or the law should accomplish these ends. I wish I could think of a specific example. Well, it was so well established that they don't need to, in 2021, have a case deciding that a judge should not, you know, deliberately violate someone's rights. You know, that's, I'm just throwing out an example. So what will happen is you have a judge that's doing something that you know is fundamentally wrong. It's going to be very hard for you to locate this 200-year-old case, or this, you know, maybe even 300-year-old case where it was established the judge shouldn't do this. We found those cases because we were working with a historian.
Yeah. And just to clarify, you would look at case law from the British system or an Anglo-Saxon system of law that the Constitution was based upon. So when you mention case law, effectively you're looking at previous cases, either from the United States or even in England or some parts of Europe, that can reference judicial behavior.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of them had been confirmed in the early parts of this country's history. So where they said, but of course you don't do this. And here you are in 2020, 2021, and that's exactly what the judge is doing. But you can't find a case that specifically prohibits that. So you're just basically arguing, you know, a concept, a construct, a notion, a platitude. And okay, that's a weak foundation because you really need to try to anchor this to precedent, but you can't find it. Then you're in a position where they're violating that under a certain set of facts. And the court puts you in a position that unless you have a case where the judge did almost exactly what your presiding judge did, they're not willing to rule that there was an offense. So the lack of precedence and sometimes the elusiveness of finding precedent to establish things that, you know, are just fundamental, but of course, it leaves you arguing based on common sense and appealing generally to senses of fairness against an audience, in front of an audience that's not receptive to your argument and not being able to anchor it in terms of this is what this court required, you know, ruled. And so it is very much a disadvantage. And then of course, as I indicated earlier, it's the moving the goalposts. I mean, you've committed at this point several years of your life. Some people actually go all the way to the US Supreme Court because they had that favorable. So you got two situations. You can't find specific precedent. So you try to establish the precedent, make this a case of first impression. You try to establish the precedent and you go all the way to the US Supreme Court and they rule against you. Or you'd go all the way to the US Supreme Court trying to enforce a precedent that seemed in your favor. They said you had to have eight elements in order to establish at least eight and you had 10. But the lower courts ruled that in this circumstance, you need 12. So you go all the way up to the US Supreme Court challenging the imposition of the 12 and lose. So you've lost a lot of time. And, you know, even if you're representing yourself, you've expended a significant amount of money. So again, this elusiveness and the moving of the goalposts is very problematic.
And it seems that for healthcare issues, this problem is particularly pronounced because healthcare tends to have complex legal issues underlying it. For the audience who may not understand to the full extent the power of your advocacy or the issue that you're addressing, can you contextualize what you're doing through the issue of abortion, what you're seeing going on in the courts with judges essentially behaving as politicians? Are you seeing precedent or a breaking of the precedent in how the judges are behaving, which may lead to potential examples of judicial misconduct?
Yes, well, you know, you're talking about judicial activism where the judges are essentially functioning as legislators under the guise of identifying rights, and that's problematic. But our organization is always taking people back to whether it's ethical or whether it's unethical, whether it's violation of the canons of ethics, judicial ethics, or it's not. You know, our country is always talking about whether a judge is conservative or liberal. And we're actually disregarding their obligation to be fair and impartial. You know, and we're actually, you know, we've gotten so, cynical that we're actually rooting for judges who have our same philosophical or political perspective, not knowing that we're really encouraging a lack of impartiality. A judge should be able to reach their determinations. I mean, it's not they don't operate in a vacuum, but it's not a liberal outcome or a conservative outcome. It's an outcome that's countenanced by the applicable law in light of the facts. And again, you know, they don't operate in a vacuum, so it could be conservative or it could be liberal. But the real problems are not so much when we have those type of political slights. The real problem is when the decision is in disregard of what is clearly the law. Those are the real problems.
Thank you so much, Dr. Crenshaw Lugo. Before I let you go, can you let the audience know how they can get a hold of you and where they can go to learn more about what you're doing?
Well, I would recommend that people go to our website because we are a small organization. And so if we have online portals that direct you to our advocacy. And if you use those online portals as opposed to contacting me directly, it allows us to get a sense of what your concerns are and make sure we have timely follow-up. So we're at, okay, you got to sort of sing it, www.njcdlp, Nancy, Jane, Cat, Dog, Larry, Paul.org, njcdlp.org. And that will get you to contacts and links to the various efforts that we're spearheading now.
Good. Thank you so much. And for those who are interested, I would certainly recommend you look up some of the writings of Dr. Crenshaw Lugo. She has been a vociferous voice in judicial accountability, and it's an issue that the country faces, but yet has no means to properly account for. So in that regard, Dr. Crenshaw Lugo is one of few in that she is really leading an issue that needs more attention. So thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Dr. Joshi.
Have a great day.
You as well.